I asked that recruiter, I said, what kind of medical device are you talking about? I imagine some big pieces of equipment, some diagnostic stuff or something. And he said, pacemakers, angiographic equipment, and neurosurgical products. His name was Nate. I said, Nate, do you have any idea what I do? Do you know that when I go into our assembly building, I'm wearing a hard hat, steel-toed shoes, and safety glasses? We got 200-ton cranes moving stuff from one place to another. And you're talking to me about pacemakers, angiographic equipment? So short answer is no, I didn't know anything about them.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Roseman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast, with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Frank Fisher, chairman of the board at NeuroPace and one of the most experienced leaders anywhere in medical device commercialization. Frank has over 40 years of senior management experience. He co-founded NeuroPace in 1997 and was the CEO from 2000 to 2019. Previously, he had led notable companies such as Ventutex and Hartford, and that's where I met Frank. Frank was a very thoughtful leader, and he's the kind of guy who is so good that companies fight to poach him from each other. When he was manager of manufacturing operation at General Electric, he was recruited to a medtech company called Cordis that wanted to improve its manufacturing operations. The same recruiter who convinced him to leave General Electric then convinced him to jump ship for Ventutex. Not surprisingly, today's episode holds a lot of insight into top-level management. I hope you enjoy our conversation. If you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our series on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Thank you for joining me today at UCSF Mission Bay Campus, Frank. It's such a pleasure to have you. I thought it would be great for our listeners to hear a little bit of your story in the beginning, from the beginning. What brought you to healthcare and for you to stay in healthcare all this time?
Well, it's actually a very unusual story. I was working for General Electric at the time, and I was the manager of manufacturing engineering for the locomotive business. So I was responsible for all process development for that business. And I received a phone call from a recruiter that I totally dismissed because he talked about an opportunity with a medical device company in Florida. And the man was persistent. We developed a friendship. I happened to mention to him, my son was just born. I happened to mention to him the family was going to go to Florida over the holidays. And he never missed a beat. He said, if you take that interview, they'll pay for your trip.
Nice.
And I said, you confirm that, and I'll see if my schedule will accommodate, and we'll figure it out. So the very first exposure was one that in never in a million years did I think that I would essentially start to work with, but fall in love with the medical device industry. So it was that beginning. And what convinced me to actually make the change was seeing the opportunity for what it meant for patients, mm-hmm. and recognizing that in reality, that's a whole lot more important than building one or more of these things and making the financial statement look a little better.
Is that when you joined Cordis?
That's when I joined Cordis. Yep, exactly.
And was it common at that time for a company like Cordis to go recruit somebody from General Electric?
It was totally unique. You may remember that I mentioned I was manager of manufacturing engineering, so we had as an organization done some pretty neat things from vertical integration and whatever else. And Cordis was looking to improve their manufacturing operation. And so that was the first time really they'd kind of reached outside of the device industry because they wanted some fresh ideas and fresh thinking. So it just, those forces came together and thankfully things turned out the way they have.
Do you know what medical devices was at that time?
I asked that recruiter, I said, what kind of medical devices are you talking about? I imagine some big pieces of equipment, some diagnostic stuff or something. And he said, pacemakers, angiographic equipment, and neurosurgical products. His name was Nate. I said, Nate, do you have any idea what I do? Do you know that when I go into our assembly building, I'm wearing a hard hat, steel-toed shoes, and safety glasses? We got 200-ton cranes moving stuff from one place to another. And you're talking to me about pacemakers, angiographic equipment? So short answer is no, I didn't know anything about them.
So you were at Cordis for how long were you?
10 years.
10 years. And so you have probably gone through so many different roles and climb up the ladder.
I basically started as director of manufacturing operations and became vice president of manufacturing for the company. And so after about 5 years, the company was then divisionalized. So there was an implantable products division that was created, and I was named president of the implantable products division.
And what made you jump to the startup?
Well, I was hoping that the lights would come on. No.
Do we have a power outage? Oh, we just have a motion. Okay. No, it never happened before.
At Cordis, the main business was the pacemaker business. And we had done an analysis there because people were at the early stages of the implantable defibrillator. There was a company called CPI, which eventually became a part of Lilly and then Guidant, that had developed the first implantable defibrillator. So we'd done some market research work, and I was somewhat familiar with the need and the opportunity. The board was looking to divest of the, and wanted to focus on angiography and divest the pacemaker business. And so as soon as that announcement was in the news, my phone rings, and guess who was on the other end of the phone? That same recruiter that had recruited me, you know, for Cordis almost 10 years before. And he said, you know, I never recruit anybody that's still part of a company that I've placed them in, but I've been retained to do this search. That's, you know, I think you'd be perfect for. And it turned out that was Ventratex. And the company was 2 years into development of what was truly a state-of-the-art implantable defibrillator, so far ahead of not only what existed, but what other people were talking about, that it, you know, I took the opportunity and just got really, really excited about what we'd be able to do. So I dragged my wife kicking and screaming from South Florida, which she really much enjoyed, out to California. And
it's not too bad.
No, we made do.
So when you arrived at Ventratex, what challenges that you face? I mean, that time they want to bring a leader like you to come for, you know, I'm sure they have their reason.
Yeah. So basically, the company at the time was about 2 years into the product development cycle that would take about 4 years between that and regulatory approval to do the first, for an IDE to start the, to do the first implant. And so there was some good technical capability that existed at the company. But the manufacturing capability at that point in time was fundamentally doing prototype work, not what you would need for production. And of course, there was no commercial activity or anything along that line. Now, at Cordis, although my responsibility was one that was for the the manufacturing and quality assurance of the implantable products, I spent a lot of time in the field and developed a good understanding of the commercial side of the business and what was necessary there. So it was really to evolve from an R&D operation to potentially a commercial operation. And of course, acquire all of the financing along the way with investors and things of this nature.
So this is the time when things were a bit less challenging compared to when you start the NeuroPace.
That's from a financing perspective.
Right.
Yes,
and,
that's very true.
But I'm sure there are still challenges when you do that. And
yeah, so what was very interesting, and so the time period that I'm talking about now is, because I joined Ventratex in 1987, and there were kind of unwritten rules that the venture community had in terms of sort of the kind of venture investors that should be added to the organization. Or not the organization, but to the financing syndicate. Some unwritten rules relative to valuations, things of this nature. And one of the things that made ultimate sense to me was that there was a real place for what the term was not used at that point, strategic. You hear that all the time now. But corporate investors, because there had to be an interest, but there was a real fear on the part of the venture investors that having a corporate investor would truly limit your exit opportunities at a later point in time. And so I didn't buy that and continued to pursue that and actually was able to convince a corporate investor to make the investment but have no rights of any kind other than the fact that we would once a year give them a financial statement so that they could consolidate in their books. But they were interested enough in the space that they really were supportive along that line. And that ended up working out very well from not only that particular financing, but then subsequent ones and things of this nature.
How did you convince your investor? Other investor to allow a strategic, because at that time probably they'll be more up in arms.
We were able to get a valuation that was 3 times higher than any one of the private guys were willing to pay. And so once they looked at that and the minimal dilution that it would then impact on them, they decided it was a pretty good idea.
You align their self-interest.
Yes.
So the strategic, is that St. Jude or is that somebody else?
No, that actually was C.R. Bard.
Oh.
And eventually, St. Jude became an investor as well, but under the same set of circumstances. They were not allowed to visit the building. It was a different time.
Right.
And we had enough at that stage in the game when St. Jude got involved. They also knew enough about the business and the potential to be really excited about it and wanting to have some kind of it was very small, visibility into the opportunity.
You definitely play it well. You have
worked
two
out.
Big ones who are part of
you. Well, as it turned out, there was also, interestingly enough, by the time St. Jude became an investor, Bard had a change in leadership and they backed out and didn't participate in the following. So yeah, it's things worked out.
I think that sometimes is also the concern, right? When you bring a strategic and then even though they're still committed in the field and then the change of leadership and their balance sheet, they decided not to participate in the next round.
That's right. You're exactly right. And it is a it's real in terms of it happening. In fact, at NeuroPace, J&J was a strategic investor for a significant period of time, and then there was a change in leadership at J&J and a requirement that half of any future investments had to go on the balance sheet of a division, and they were not in the neuromodulation business and elected not to continue to invest on a going forward basis. So all that means is it's a different kind of challenge that you need to deal with. But I would encourage anybody that's thinking along that line not to let that be a deterrent because it's one more really viable potential source of financing.
I think it's important how to manage it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's what that is. So with that success with the venture techs, and do you take any gap year before you went to Hartport?
I went very quickly from the closing of the deal with St. Jude to Kleiner Perkins as a CEO in residence.
Okay.
And so I had gotten to know Joe Lacob at Kleiner, and then subsequently the other partners. And because we were, interestingly enough, on the Hartport board together. And I joined Kleiner, and the idea was sort of to do basically three things. One was we had presented to them the concept of NeuroPace and got agreement that they would be the seed investor to determine whether or not the basics that had to be proven could work so that the Hartport system or the NeuroPace system could be developed. And so that was one. The second was they had invested in a company called Therox and asked if I would be an active chairman for Therox, which was great and a lot of fun and did it, you know, until the company was acquired by Zoll recently. And then the third was the NeuroPace and starting first on the board. And then, but I always kind of knew that if NeuroPace, if we could prove that those two basic needs, repeating of the pattern of elliptiform activity and can stimulation disrupt the elliptiform activity, that would be the area that I'd really be interested in because it played with technology. I was very, although not specific for the brain, but you could see how the technology could be modified and applied to neurologic disorders. And then there was a host of other things. The appeal of not getting to a place where it would be kind of a real market share game with existing companies that were in the space and whatever else, and the opportunity to fill an incredible need because you know there are a million people in the U.S. that have uncontrolled seizures.
Right, it's huge.
So, you know, that was all the excitement associated with that.
But when you were at Kleiner, those are during the dot-com era as well. So tell us about your experience dabbling in that space.
Well, I was a total observer when it came to the dot-com discussions and decisions that were being made at Kleiner. I would get to sit in the partner meetings every Monday, and I would hear people talking about the key criteria being the number of eyeballs you have looking at this particular indication, and I'm scratching my head thinking, boy, I don't know what that means.
And what does that mean?
It just means the amount of people that would be interested in the space. You know, how many people can you get? And then the whole idea was that how many, what kind of massive investment could be made quickly such that other competitive approaches would be blocked out. And the idea was, it's kind of the classic way that people think about, you know, competitive stuff is development of intellectual property and trade secrets and things of this nature. But back in those days, everything was envisioned to be happening so fast that wouldn't occur. So the whole, it was get as much money as you could as possible into these other, you know, areas. And I think I may have, I remember going home and telling my wife, "Well, I don't know what's going on with these discussions." But
you were not lured by the promised land that they promised everybody.
But it was, and clearly, you know, there were some unbelievable investments that have been made by the Kleiner team that were Amazon, Google, you know, just incredible, great investments from both that partnership and their investors' perspective.
Yeah.
But in my case, I was just I tell them I'm just a simple medical device guy. You know, it's going to it's got kind of bread and butter and march you through the steps for me.
Right.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com.
So you had us in a year or so plus at Hartford, because I remember that's where I met you.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what happened was, you may remember that it was in 1998. Hartford had the challenges associated with very high expectations being set on the part of the financial community.
Right.
The successful public offering, the beginning of sales, and then a rather rapid plateauing of those sales. And so Kleiner was one of the major investors in Hartford, and so Kleiner and the other major investor asked if I would join the company to see what we might be able to do about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's when you found out the NeuroPace result came out short after.
Yeah, during that period of time, we determined that. So that was 1998, first half of 98. And then by sort of the second half of 99, we learned that one, those elliptiform patterns would repeat, and two, simulation would disrupt, so that the basics that we needed to go forward with NeuroPace were proven.
Can maybe for the listener to understand why that matters, why this information that you need to get, why matters?
To take a step backwards, so what we do with the NeuroPace device is for patients that have a form of epilepsy, which is the most difficult to control, by the way, with drug therapy, known as focal onset or partial onset epilepsy. We place electrodes at or near those foci. We can treat one or two foci with a given patient. That constitutes about 85% of the patient population. The idea then is to be able to tune the device to look for the patient's unique pattern of onset that could then trigger stimulation. But before we started, one of the things that had to be proven was, for a given patient, does that pattern of onset repeat or not? Because nobody had ever done a study with indwelling electrodes to know that answer. The second question was, if that was the case, where this unusual activity was developing and stimulation was delivered, could you disrupt that unusual activity so the rest of the brain would not synchronize on it, resulting in a seizure? So if those two things could be accomplished, then we had the fundamental basis for the system and product as we know it to be developed. But if the answer was no, then all bets were off in terms of figuring out what we might do, if anything, on a going forward basis. So it was those two things that that were established in the what are known as the monitoring units, the epilepsy monitoring units of one of the hospitals.
And so when you got that news, that must be like, great, we got like slam dunk.
Well,
and that turned out to be also become a long journey for you.
I have not tried to find the original business plan for NeuroPace, but I would absolutely bet that we probably thought that the time period from inception of the company to a public offering for the company would have been very similar to what it was for Ventratex. And that was 8 years. And I obviously have forgotten how to do math, because we've been at it for 20 and we're still a private company.
Why do you think that would be similar to Ventratex, and why it turned out that it's not?
Yeah, that's really a great question. So when I looked at the NeuroPace opportunity, the first thing that you always look at is the clinical need. You know, so you ask yourself that question, is there a large unmet clinical need? And the answer to that was yes. Did it look like you had an approach that could have an impact with that? And after we proved the two things that I talked about, we all believed that, yes, that looked like this could be an opportunity. From the standpoint of developing a product, it was, when you thought about sort of the basic technologies from a mechanical, electrical, software perspective that it would take, they would be very different in the application, but very similar in terms of the basic kinds of technologies. And so thinking that the length of time to develop a product for the epilepsy application would be of the same order as the one that we had was not, in my mind, still as logical. In fact, it's kind of what it took us to actually do that. The differences were that once you came into the clinical trial regulatory portion of this, it was different from several vantage points. The first was that with Ventratex, we didn't have to do a feasibility study because there had been previous devices implanted, in that case abdominally, with leads going up to the heart. And so it was a matter of being able to go directly to a pivotal trial. And although the materials that we used with the NeuroPace product were the same kinds of materials externally that the body would be exposed to, and our thought was that, there was precedent with a cranial implant, with cochlear implants, for example, the materials were the same. Electrodes had not been planted chronically in the brain, but we believed that since the materials were the same and there would be no relative motion of those electrodes, because if everything's implanted in the head, there's no stress, no strain, there's no movement that you would suspect. So we thought that we would be able to go directly to a pivotal trial. FDA had different ideas.
They always do.
They said, that's nice try, but no, we're not going to. And we had several meetings with them to introduce them to the idea and the technology and had great relationships. So they actually let us go very quickly to an IDE, mm-hmm. but it was an IDE for a feasibility trial, not an IDE for a pivotal trial. Mm-hmm. So that through another 2 to 3 years kind of into the cycle. And then the second thing that was different was with the implantable defibrillator, it was an established, at that point in time, there was a product was on the market. There was at least one other company at that stage that had a clinical trial going on with their product. So it was kind of a widely accepted technology, and frankly, the physician specialty was a subset of the cardiology called the electrophysiologist, and they were very interested in getting their hands on products. It wasn't unusual for them, and so they embraced it. And we quickly went through the clinical trial period. In the case of a device to treat epilepsy, it's the neurologist that controls the patient. Mm-hmm. And neurologists, for the most part, have been trained over the years that, there's got to be a medicine that they'll try. And particularly in the community, not necessarily at academic centers, but particularly in the community, they'll continue to try one medication after another. But that had been sort of the nature of it. So the idea of going to an implantable device
seems very extreme.
Was very different for them. So, and they're a very scientifically based, cautious group. So that moved much slower than I thought for both enrollment in the feasibility trial as well as enrollment in the pivotal trial.
Do you think with the had you done it now with the FDA, it probably would have moved faster compared to when you're doing it at that time.
You know, I still think that FDA today would require a feasibility trial if we were the first to do this. I still think they would have required both trials. And so, and frankly, at the time of submitting the IDE for both the feasibility trial as well as the pivotal trial, the approval of the IDE was very fast. We submitted the IDE. They had one round for the feasibility trial. They had one round of questions. So 4.5 months from the time we made the original submission, it was approved, so we could begin. But then the other thing that changed between doing a trial for implantable defibrillators as contrasted to the RNS system, hospitals no longer just let you go start a trial. You had to go through a whole contracting process with them. You had to go through an IRB process with them. There were questions relative to payment from a, and I'm not talking about payment of the device, because in both of our trials, we provided the devices free of charge, but this was for all of the other services. And we were what was known then as a Category B product. So, you know, for CMS, for example, would pay for Medicare patients for the rest of their normal hospital expenses and physician expenses. But it still was a very slow new process as compared to when we did the implantable defibrillator, because none of that stuff existed.
Right.
So
all this wrinkle that you didn't...
Yeah, all of those things ended up having a very substantial impact on how long these things took. So the feasibility trial, patients were enrolled from 2004 to 2006. The pivotal trial from 2006 to 2009. We had to gather data on all of the pivotal trial patients up to a year after they had completed, they had been implanted. So that took us into 2010. Then you get the data, you do all of the analysis associated with that, and then we made our submission in the last quarter of 2010. But what happened at FDA during that period of time, you may remember, there was that whole period where there were these whistleblowers in Congress, and everything just shut down. And so I would say that there was probably a 2+ year period of time after we had made our submission that it was just back and forth with questions and requests for more analysis and discussions and this, that, and the other thing. And it was painful, doesn't begin to describe it.
But at the same time, that's kudos to you that even with all that time, because many of the startup had to shut down.
Oh, yes.
But you continue moving and managed to raise funding to continue the operation.
The thing that you're...
How did you do that?
Well, the thing that we had going for ourselves that many other startups didn't were the patient outcomes. You know, we had, if you think about that period of time, so that was post-2010, and we had patient outcomes that we've been gathering since 2004. And so we didn't weren't in a situation where we were talking about theoretical benefit or hoping for benefit. We could demonstrate that, look, you know, it's great for the patient, and you know, logic and common sense have to prevail here eventually, so hang in there with us, will you? And for the most part, people did. During this whole period of time, the absolute lowest of the low was in about July of 2012. So we've been, you know, going back and forth here with a year and a half or so with FDA. And we had answered another series of questions, and we were expecting an answer back from them. And what we were actually expecting was that they would give us a panel date. And And then the time, you know, you always have these rough guidelines, and the time period when we should have heard, you know, was just about there. And we had periodic company meetings. So we're having a company meeting, and being the ever optimistic guy that I am, I'm telling folks that, and because it's what I believe is, look, we haven't heard from the agency yet relative to a panel date. And I think there's a darn good chance they've decided our data is so good we don't need to go to panel. And so here's this whole, you know, our whole kitchen, that's where we have our company meetings, you know, full of people. And basically I'm telling them, all right, now let's make sure that we're getting ready here, because, you know, let's dust off all of our plans for making product and doing everything else under the sun, because this could be it. As I'm walking out of the door, our senior director of IT is standing there with a piece of paper in her hand. And she said, I think you better look at this. And it was a fax that had come into our unsecured fax machine in the middle of the company that she just happened to pick up from FDA.
I do not know that they fax people paper.
Yeah. Denying our PMA. Denying it. Not telling us we're going to panel. Saying, no, your PMA is denied. Well, okay, everybody back in the kitchen. Here's what happened. You need to know that. We'll go figure it out. And we did. And then had some subsequent conversation with the agency, and actually appealed at their suggestion, appealed. And then there was a very thorough and comprehensive and good appeal process that was run by them. Mm-hmm. And essentially, they said that was not appropriate on our part. In reviewing this, we are withdrawing our denial of your PMA. Oh. That's the only time that I've ever heard that actually happened. And we will work with you to assign a panel date, which they did. And then so that panel took place in February of 2013, and we received a unanimous recommendation for approval from the panel.
I just want to make sure your hearts sink before.
Well, it worked.
So how many patients now have you used? I mean, how many patients have used the NeuroPace?
Something right more than 2,500. It was the first week in December when we implanted our 2,500th patient.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
And you probably, NeuroPace probably has the most data when it comes to brain stimulation right now.
Well, what we store in the device itself, as I indicated before, the electrodes are placed near the seizure focus. So that electrical information is coming in through the device. And when the detection parameters are met, that segment of electrocorticograph, and the physician can adjust what length of time before detection and after he or she can choose. And typically it's 60 seconds before and then 90 seconds after. So that segment is frozen and is stored in the device. Every patient has a remote monitor that they use to download the information stored in the device, send it to our patient data management system. From the patient data management system, the patient's physician, any place they can connect to the internet, can access that information. So if their patient's a couple of hundred miles away, calls up, you know, loop, doctor can look and have some immediate recommendation to the patient, come into the office or something, you know, whatever he or she may choose to do. But we have approximately 5 million of those segments. And for the patients that were in the clinical trials, the 256 patients in the clinical trials, there's also outcomes data associated with each one of those patients. Mm-hmm. And so what we're in the process of doing now is utilizing artificial intelligence techniques to be able to go through and essentially identify stuff that can't be seen by the human eye, that will look at similarities, and this is the really amazing thing, similarities in what I'll call a scheduled ECOG. So in addition to the electrocardiograph data being stored when detection parameters are met, the physician also typically says, picks a time a day where they just do a background recording. And so that's referred to as scheduled. Typically, it's done during the night. And it's really looking at those background electrocardiograph segments. The AI techniques are finding stuff in there to find patients with similar kinds of background ECOGs, and then looking at what parameters have been programmed for them for both detection and simulation. And then what are their outcomes? And coming back with that information says, for this patient, I recommend this these settings in order to move, you know, from where you are now to where you want to be. And to put in perspective the benefits of this kind of thing, so I referred before to our feasibility trial and our pivotal trial. Each of those ran for two-year periods. But we gave patients the opportunity to enroll in a seven-year prospective trial after they completed either one of those first two. Mm-hmm. 97% of the patients that were eligible said, yes, I want to do that. So we have seven additional years, or a total of 9 years of prospectively gathered data on each of the clinical trial patients. Wow. And it took us year six for patients to receive a 67% median seizure frequency reduction compared to their baseline, because we're trial and error with all of these settings. And year nine to get to 75%. Mm-hmm. And we just did a real world study, and because of these improvements in techniques and analysis, in year one, we're now at 67%, 68 actually, mm-hmm. and 75% in year two. Oh. And the preliminary look at year three is 82%. Oh. So it looks like it's really bringing that stuff in, you know, much, much sooner.
So when you started NeuroPace, did this ever, you know, did you guys think about this potential data that you have and leverage the data, or...
I wish I could say that we were so smart that we did. But fact of the matter is, the reason that we built the capability was to inform the physician so that the physician would have a basis to make programming changes. Mm-hmm. And we did not envision the benefits of the data. But it's absolutely incredible. Let me give you a couple other examples. I'll try to do it briefly, but... One of the frustrating things for physicians and patients when they're first diagnosed with epilepsy is there are perhaps 35 drugs that are approved to treat epilepsy, but there's no test to determine which of the drugs might be the most beneficial for an individual. So it's trial and error, and it can be just what is the doctor comfortable prescribing, what have they had some degree of success with that they feel good about, whatever the reasons are, and then they'll just, you know, kind of march through, mm-hmm. and they might try a new drug or this, that, and the other thing. Well, one of the things that we also do with the implanted system is we accumulate the number of detections, the number of times in any period of time that detection parameters are met. And there's also something else called a long episode, and that can be programmed as to what length you define it as. But there's a good correlation between both of those so-called biomarkers, between that and the number of clinical seizures. It's not a one-for-one, but it's proportionate. Mm-hmm. So if you were a physician and you're trying to just select a drug for a patient, well, you're going to wait 3 to 6 months for that patient to come back for their follow-up visit, and then you're going to depend on what the patient says and a seizure log that they are asked to keep, and sometimes they do, to judge whether or not that drug's effective or not, and decide to make a change if they decide it's not effective. We can tell a physician, by virtue of the number of detections in a histogram, whether that drug is likely to be effective in 1 to 2 weeks. So it dramatically improves not only the benefit that the patient can get from the neurostimulation therapy, but also in terms of what it informs the physician of. So there's other situations where people have triggers for seizures that some are known. I mean, there are visual anomalies that can cause seizure-related activity for some people, but there's others that they don't know. And so by correlating when there's an unusual uptake in activity and then the physician being able to talk to the patient about what's going on there, there's a case study written up at the Cleveland Clinic where there's a patient that happened to be highly susceptible to caffeine. And she would go out with her friends, and alcohol also is a potential trigger. Yeah. And so, you know, she actually would go periodically to have to go to the emergency room. And after one of those instances, the physician said, well, where did it happen? She said, it happened to such and such, and it happened to be a bar. And so he said, and what were you drinking? And she said, how much alcohol did you have? And she said, I don't drink alcohol. And he's going, come on, you know, you're in the bar, you're having a seizure, come on. And she's, no, I don't. So what do you drink? She said, I drink Dr. Pepper. And it turned out she was having, it was caffeinated Dr. Pepper that was essentially when her levels of caffeine would get up too high, she'd end up having seizures. But, you know, how do you find out? We just had we have 75 patient ambassadors. One of our patient ambassadors just found out that one of her triggers is, get this, orange juice.
Oh.
Who the heck would ever think that orange juice could be a trigger for seizures? And that's what she has. So, I mean, it's all kinds of stuff like this.
And it's
this
so different for everybody,
too. Yeah, but never imagined in a million years that you'd be able to learn this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
When we put that capability in place.
I always think that orange juice is the safest thing to drink without the sugar.
Exactly.
But there's so much to talk about, and I know we're running out of time. It's been so much pleasure for me to have you at our podcast. I have more time, but it's really exciting. I found the work that you do at NeuroPace, I think it's going to change so many people's lives.
Well, thanks so much, Christine. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you about this.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening today, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.